Hi, this is Paul. One of the places I get feedback from is this little listserv called CRC Voices that I've participated in for decades. It's mostly a few CRC people who write there reliably, and it's a really nice mix of people sort of not all the way across the political spectrum, really across the political spectrum in the Christian Reformed Church. It's probably more weighted to conservatives than progressives because that's sort of how the Christian Reformed Church is. But many of us have known each other for decades, and we have a high degree of trust in each other, which means we can fight like crazy if we need to. One of the things that one of the individuals there is pushing back on some of my videos and some of the stuff that I've been reading, posted on Voices this podcast titled The Good Fight. I think I had it on my feed, I think, for a while, and I took it down. I cleaned my thing out for a while. And it's got Elizabeth Brunig on religion, liberalism, and wokeness. Now, there's probably going to be two videos that come out about this because they're really two separate topics. Elizabeth Brunig is a staff writer at The Atlantic and a Catholic socialist who writes on topics as varied as capital punishment and mothering two children while in her 20s. Her work is uniquely marked by her ruby red Texas upbringing, the elite professional world she now inhabits, and her deep sense of morality, which draws from both Christian theology and left-wing politics. In this wide-ranging conversation, Elizabeth Brunig and Yascha Mounk debate the importance of dialogue across moral perspectives, whether wokeness bears any resemblance to theology, and how religious convictions can raise an authentic liberal defense of free speech. Now, I'm not actually going to talk about the wokeness in this video because I don't have the time to do both of them at once. I first want to talk about some of the earlier comments that she made about dating and marriage. So as you hear, she comes out of a very red place in Texas, but she's part of this Catholic socialist tradition, which now many of you know Roman Catholics to be pretty conservative people. Well, there's obviously this whole Catholic socialist tradition. The most prominent member lives in the Vatican? I don't know. Y'all can debate that. Can debate that here. So she talks about meeting her now husband, then boyfriend, when she was in high school. They're the only two people that each of them dated. They married young. They had children young. And then I'll start playing it here.
Right. I mean, you know, so those things kind of occur to me, and I just have a real problem getting on board with that sort of thing. So there are legitimate reasons to object to my politics, and I don't want to downplay that. But there are issues also with the cultural side of who I am. For international listeners, right, the United States is a really large country. The regional differences are difficult to overstate. I am, and my husband are from Texas, which is in the southern part of the United States. It's the best state. It's almost the only one. We're from the northern part of Texas. We grew up around the block from each other. We went to the same gigantic public high school in North Texas where we met on our debate team. I was 16. He was 18. He was my debate team captain. And we sort of agreed right then and there that we were going to get married. This wasn't totally unusual in the culture where we were brought up. My mom and dad also met in high school in that same city and married when my mom was 18. And so again, not totally atypical for where we were from. But we were smart kids. My husband won a full ride scholarship to the University of Oklahoma because he did so well on a standardized test that we take in the United States, the PSAT. He was a National Merit Scholar. I went to Brandeis, which is near Boston, way up on the East Coast. And he went to Boston University Law School, where he won another very large scholarship for public service because he wanted to do labor law. I won a Marshall Scholarship to go to Cambridge and study Christian theology, got my master's in philosophy. And so the fact of the matter is that we were two people who came out of North Texas in this culture that's traditionally conservative. It's a red state. It's a Republican state. It's a very Christian area. Actually, we come from Tarrant County in Texas, which is the most reliably red county in Texas. And then we wind up on the East Coast, which is this very blue, very liberal, very highly educated, not necessarily especially religious, especially in the professional classes place. And we just don't quite fit in. We got married as soon as we were done with our educations. We dated the whole time. My husband's the only person I've ever dated. We married when I was 23. I got pregnant when I was 24. We had our first baby when I was 25. We had our next when I was 28. Now I'm 30, and we've been married for 7 years. This is just atypical for this area. And I think the degree to which I enjoy it and he enjoys it, that we like each other, is I think there's a kind of style in this part of the country of being kind of fashionably busy and frustrated with your home life. And this is actually the part of my life I'm happiest with.
Now, okay, so part of, to kind of slow this down, she talks fast. So she's 30, she's been married for 7 years, she's had two kids, both of the kids in the 20s, they come out of West Texas, a very red state. Her and her husband are both very progressive, very left-wing. They're also religious, and so they're oddities in some ways.
Part of it, I think, is the way in which your personal life is objectively different from that of most people in our broadly sort of political and intellectual circles, certainly having kids probably about a decade earlier than most people would and so on. But I wonder whether part of it is just being vocal about it, in the sense that, you know, something that really struck in my mind is something that a former guest of this podcast, David French, has said to me. We said, look, you know, if I go to this conference we were at, which was mostly liberals, and I told them, you know, it would be good for America if most people got married at a relatively young age and had stable relationships and had two-parent families and children, people would be really upset and say that this is moralistic and that it's imposing my morality on other people and perhaps even that it's somehow discriminatory of certain groups and so on.
Okay, so he's got a bit of an accent might be hard for some of you to find, to follow. I believe he said, you know, David French. He talks about how it is currently in many places, like this woman describes, on the East Coast, many secular spaces. It is considered problematic. It is considered bigoted. It is considered unkind to publicly promote the idea for people to marry young and to have children young, that this is somehow, this is not right. It is unwise. It is harmful. In other words, there's a collective assumption about wisdom and morality with respect to getting married young, having children young, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot that goes into that, and not all of it is unfounded, given, yeah, how smart are you at picking a spouse when you're 21 or 23 or 24? Maybe you'll do a better job at 30. Now, of course, because spouse picking is something that we leave our young people to do, obviously in past generations, arranged marriages, parents picked. Why would you leave something that critical and that important to people who don't know anything of life? But now, of course, we've had a youth revolution. We continue to have a generation gap. Older people are ill-equipped to understand the demands of life on younger people. So younger people are deciding, no, what we want is not only do we have adolescence, but then we have this new space after adolescence, which is college and beyond college, where it's basically your job to go out and find sexual partners, yada, yada, yada. So let's contrast what she's about to say, which you don't know and I do, because I've listened to it already, obviously, with a little bit of this wisdom that we get from Chris Williamson's channel, talking about polygamy now from the perspective of a married man.
Looking back at your period of non-monogamy now as a happily married man, woman of your dreams, does that reframe that sort of experience? Do you have a different sort of view of non-monogamy generally now? Was it just part of a journey? Where's your headspace at with that?
It was definitely part of a journey. It was definitely part of like a deep learning practice. I mean, we all have jealousy to a certain extent. You know, it's just inherent. And if you think you're not jealous, I dare you to get into a non-monogamous relationship where your sweetheart is getting fucked by somebody else and you're home alone and just imagining what's happening. Like, if you can do that, like, fucking get an ashram somewhere. Like, I don't know. I don't know what it takes to be able to handle that. But, you know, so you really confront the dragon. You confront the dragon of your own jealousy. Like, the thought of me being jealous in my current relationship now with Vailana is absolutely preposterous, because I've lived the worst case scenario. You know, like, I've lived the absolute nightmare of you know, jealousy so many times that I'm liberated from that. It's just not in the spectrum of possibility.
Now what's interesting here is that in many ways, if advising young people to marry young and basically surf the rough waters of relationships from within a marriage, rather than deciding to go out there with your surfboard and ply non-monogamy or however you want to frame it on your own, it's better to sort of keep the marriage pure by sowing lots of wild oats before. That seems to be the majority wisdom take. Now, it's implicit. I remember one of my sons going to college, and the assistant basketball coach, my wife and I were running we're working in the fireworks booth. That's how California, even despite our high taxes, or at least our high sales taxes, funds extracurricular activities in high school. Made a comment that when my oldest son, who went to a Christian college, what we should have done was given him an enormous box of condoms and say, don't come back until you've used them all. No. but you know, listening to this video a little bit today was just amazing, because the idea was, okay, the assumption is, well, first of all, you can have multiple partners, I suppose, if you're very high status, good-looking, alpha men who can, you know, because from what I hear from people, that a tiny percentage of men are sleeping with most of the women. I mean, we're basically practicing polygamy in a non-marital context, because birth control now makes sexual activity far less costly for women and for men. You know, now the assumption is, well, go out and, you know, do your thing. And, well, if you're going to get through this, well, then you're going to have to get in terms of your, you're going to have to get in touch with not being jealous, or we can put it in sort of Eastern religious terms, not developing attachments to the people that you're sexually intimate with, even though we might just think about the idea that perhaps biologically, psychologically, feelings of intimacy and connection are in fact properly tied with sexual intimacy. But we won't go there, because of course sexual intimacy is for experimentation and recreation.
Of what I would actually worry about. And that's one of the beautiful things that you'll get from it. And that's what happens when you go head.
Unless you fail the test of mastering your jealousy and you go out and beat somebody to a pulp and wind up in jail. No, this is sort of gaining self-control by avoiding incarceration.
First into your deepest fears or your deepest challenges. It's like the ayahuasca of jealousy. You're in it. So that's beautiful. It's also beautiful that, I mean, I got to experience so many amazing people. And actually, I was only able to meet my wife and become friends because I had the freedom of a non-monogamous container. Like, if I wanted to go out on a friend date or whatever with Vailana, like, there was never any question, because I had multiple other girlfriends. So it's not like there was an issue, you know, like, I was really free. So I think it's a great path to overcome jealousy. It's also a great path if you're not quite sure. I loved Whitney a lot, but something wasn't just quite right. You know, she's amazing. Whitney's fucking incredible, but it wasn't quite right for either of us. And we both actually subsequently after since splitting, you know, we're still friends, but both of us have really come into our own in a beautiful way. She's a country singer now, you know, and she's like using her voice and she's recording songs and songs are amazing. And I always wanted her to sing, but in our relationship, it just, that never emerged. Like there was ways in which we weren't clicking for each other's future. So the fact that we chose non-monogamy was perfect because we were both free to explore different people and learn different things. And it was beautiful. I got to meet some amazing, amazing humans, you know, Stephanie and Savannah and Maya and so many like awesome people that I'm just so grateful that I got a chance to experience.
Now, when I listen to these two talking, now remember, this is modern wisdom. This is being given to us as wisdom. Okay. And that's very different from the wisdom that we're going to hear now by this Catholic socialist that's on the other channel. But when I listen to these two and when I watch, like I've mentioned, you know, partly because I always give my kids the remote and say, let's watch what you want to watch. And I enjoy it too, you know, because they'd say, you know, you haven't averted your eyes. You know, when we watch The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, this is the kind of thing I see. And it's always striking for me too. Like so often on The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, you know, I remember one bachelor who, you know, he was talk about his Christian faith. Oh, that's very important to me. But, you know, they're all going to have their overnight. And there's absolutely no assumption. I mean, when a virgin comes on those shows, it's like they put a giant neon sign, virgin, 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 virgin. It's like, you know, it'd be like an extraterrestrial has landed into, you know, the bachelors in Paradise Beach. And everybody wants to, you know, well, I guess that's one way to heighten the status and heighten the now suddenly scarcity has brought an increase in market value, perhaps. So this is, for the most part, as I see it out there in the 20-something world, this is the current regime in blue state America. The idea is that you go out and you try on lots of people until you mate your soulmate or you find your match for your, you know, you find your person, you find that match for your secret, sacred self. And then, you know, all this, well, this is going to be forever. This is going to be forever. But it almost never is forever because there's always the talk about, well, this is for this chapter in my life and for that chapter in my life. There's that chatting rider on the elephant is doing a whole lot of PR work, making sure that no matter what happens, that we've all done the best we could do, and we're all living our best life now, and we're all keeping up appearances, and everything is wonderful. And this, of course, is a marked departure from, you know, what we find here in the podcast.
But when I look at what the attendees at this conference are actually doing in their lives, they are mostly married. They are in stable relationships. You know, there's an open bar and people can get as drunk as they want and they could have affairs. They're away from the families, but nobody does that. Everybody has one and a half drinks and then goes to bed at 11:30 p.m. And
in other words, for all this talk about sowing your wild oats and doing all these things, marriage is, well, all of the elites. Why do we love Barack and Michelle? You know, is Barack out there being a randy fellow, you know, hiring really sexy, you know, is he managing to square the circle and both be an unapproachable, faithful, married man and act like the governor of New York and propositioning? No, you know, the women love Barack because he's faithful to his wife. And gosh, would sure love to sleep with a man who's faithful to his wife. It's like, wait, no, yes, it, you know, there it is. And so they make the point that among the elites, and we've seen this again, they preach libertinism, but they live Puritanism because it works for them.
Their own bed. And so there is sort of an odd thing where actually, I'm in France at the moment as I'm recording this. France is a pretty messy country in terms of the lives people lead, including the elites of the country.
Okay, France, he said. France is a messy country in terms of the lives that people lead.
Country lead pretty messy lives. America is a country in which actually the lives that people lead in the elite often aren't all that messy. They are quite true.
The lives of the elite aren't that messy. They preach libertinism, but they live Puritanism. Now, there's just something about the, someone could argue that, well, maybe a Puritan lifestyle actually affords success in life, therefore gaining in a more meritocratic society and a chance to access elite ranges. Or maybe it's just because America continues to be in some ways far more conservative, which is kind of what they were complaining about, far more conservative, and therefore this is just the way Americans are.
Traditional. Most of the people I know don't have kids out of wedlock. They, you know, have pretty stable relationships.
But now, he's talking about the elite. And what we've seen over the last couple of generations is that having kids out of wedlock, now the lower classes and the working classes are doing this, and this is where we get into Rob Henderson's his conversation with Jordan Peterson, but if you follow him on Twitter, luxury beliefs, or let's say luxury morality, where, you know, it's too bad that, and there's a lot to this. It is marriage and, let's say, a single income household where the wife can stay home. There's a lot about this in the Mars Hill podcast, which I haven't really dug into that, but so there's a lot going on here, and it's not just morality or religiosity. It does have to deal with economics. But again, I know many people, and I hear them in my consciousness, Congress will say, well, but in fact, if you discipline yourself, you can live on one income. You just have to, maybe you'll homeschool, maybe you'll adjust your income in various ways. In other words, self-discipline and Puritanism does in fact pay off economically in the long run. And what happens in at least a broadly or in to some degrees a meritocratic society is that hard work and self-control really will pay off. And maybe it will and maybe it won't. We certainly know that dissolute living usually doesn't get you anywhere unless you are already at the top of a rather stratified and rigidly stratified social society so that you have the money to indulge in these luxury beliefs and skate around.
But the political sin is not living like that. It's taking joy in living like that and saying, but that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds right. There's this long-standing argument about preaching what you practice and so forth among the professional managerial class. One thing I will say is that, you know, the professional managerial class, when they do have kids, they settle down into these monogamous relationships. They have a glass of wine. They go to bed at 11:30 and they...
And now I dare bet that I haven't followed. I have no idea who Aubrey Marcus is. Probably some of you know, and you'll let me know in the comments, which I'd be grateful for. You know, given the fact that Chris Williamson rose to fame on Love Island, maybe this guy is another alpha male or an F-boy, as they might be called on HBO Max. And in fact, high status, they do settle down. I mean, Kim Kardashian rose to fame with her friend Paris Hilton. Not known for Puritan lifestyles. Of course, Kim and Kanye for a while settle in and become these idealized. I mean, that's sort of become the elite, the aspirational marital trajectory for Americans. That, you know, play around, be non-monogamous, get into bed, but all the time be, you know, longing for that special someone who is out there, and it'll be special and it will be for life, and all that idealism, all of that is what you shoot for. And then you grab the ideal at the marriage, and so you invoke all of the You invoke all of the religiosity and all of the symbolism because you're telling everyone this person is for life. And then maybe it will be and maybe it won't be. But when it isn't, you know that maybe that person was right for a time, or but they weren't really the one. And so then you just kind of go through your life looking for the one until you get cynical and say, I'm not sure if there is a one. I'm not sure if this rather Gnostic dualist identity that I have, where there's a secret sacred self and then there's the life that I'm living, and I'm always looking for the secret sacred self, and I'm looking for religions or spiritualities or practices that can get me in touch with my true self, and then once I find my true self, then I'll find my soulmate and then we'll live the storybook. But of course, you know, if you kind of burn through your 20s being non-monogamous and you settle down into your 30s, well, you know, better hope that your woman isn't too old. And so, I mean, that's the way it's going. But then, okay, so then, boy, those marital years, especially those early, how many kids you're going to have? Well, of course, contraception is involved. These two have only had two children so far, and they're Catholic. They're not Rod Dreher Catholics, I would imagine. I don't know. I'm not going to ask. But one does wonder, I'll say that, if you're serious about a religious tradition that, of course, says contraception is a no-no. Okay, so where's this go? I mean, we're sort of seeing it play out in America today, but now Elizabeth Bruning is, of course, a rather odd duck when it comes to a lot of this. She's a leftist that's a Catholic, and she writes about wokeness and so on and so forth. And the wokeness part is a very interesting part of the conversation too. But again, I'm not going to go there because this other part of the conversation was very interesting.
Live these very stable, buttoned up among the professional managerial class. One thing I will say is that, you know, the professional managerial class, when they do have kids, they settle down into these monogamous relationships. They have a glass of wine, they go to bed at 11:30, and they live these very stable, buttoned up lives that they wouldn't necessarily cop to. I think the difference between the lives that my peers live and the life that I live is, like you say, we did it about a decade younger. And I think that time disparity causes quite a bit of stress for a number of reasons. For one thing, you know, there's a scarcity problem. So there are all these impending issues. I don't know if you saw a recent Wall Street Journal article about the disparity between the number of men and women who are graduating from college at this point, but there is about a 20-point disparity between the number of men and women who are graduating from college. That means there are going to be many, many more female college graduates than male college graduates, which means women with higher earning potential, men with lower earning potential, which traditionally has put men at a disadvantage for marriage, which means you're going to have a professional managerial class where lots of professional women with high earning potential are either going to marry men with much lower earning potential, or they're not going to marry at all. They're going to marry men who don't have college degrees. So you're going to have female lawyers and doctors marrying firemen and cops, or you're going to have female lawyers and doctors never getting married at all.
I won't name him. I have a friend who right away when I started talking was talking to me about these things. I'd really love for him to come on the channel and talk about these things at some point. And you're listening right now and you know who you are and you know that I'm talking about you. Some of you might think I'm talking about you and you're wrong, but this one individual knows exactly what I'm talking about and that I'm talking to him. He, for a long time, right away said, there's an apocalypse coming. And we're just seeing the beginning of it. Jordan Peterson mentions this when he says, women get into careers in their 20s and they're thinking, they're filled with the imagination of meaning that their careers are going to make them happy and fill them with meaning. And then when they get into, then when they're in their 30s and then their careers, they're beginning to get a sense that this career isn't that meaningful. And sometime, probably in their mid-30s, they're keeping an eye on that biological clock, and some people have frozen eggs, and, you know. Now, of course, we're talking about managerial class elites here. And they're thinking, oh, I want a man. I want a husband. I want to have a family. I want this image out there, which, you know, it's really amazing because we kick down at Leave It to Beaver and the Huxtables, of course, now with Cosby. It's just oh, so ironic. But we kick down on these family shows. But just like Rob Henderson said, you know, he goes to the elite universities, and you have all of these women saying, "Well, I believe that monogamy and marriage is a patriarchal institution." Well, what do you want? Well, I want to get married and have children. Oh, okay. Thanks for supporting the patriarchy. Oh, but I'm going to do it differently. There won't be patriarchy in that. We'll be, you know, even in Christianity, we'll be egalitarians. Well, congratulations. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but I was watching the Family Feud. Scott got on a YouTube Family Feud kick the other day, and surveyed 100 married men, and they will do blank for sex. And what was amazing about that clip is that none of the women knew the answers, and all of the men did know the answers. And the answers male gave were: men will beg for sex, ding. Men will kill for sex, ding. Men will die for sex, ding. They ask a woman. A man will clean for sex, bah. No, he won't do that. He might die and kill and beg, but he won't clean. And it was all just so true. So there's this impending apocalypse that right now it's out there, and I hear rumors of it, and I really should pull the gang together and do another dating, a generational handoff marriage crisis video. But it's out there, and we're hearing whispers of it. And when my wife comes back from some retreat thing and says, "I know I have all these women, they're 35 years old, and they're saying there's no men out there, and why can't I find a man?" And my wife's like, "These women, they're attractive, they're successful, they're well put together, they're all these things, and they can't find a man." So then I said to my wife, "How much do they want these potential men to be making in their careers?" "Oh, well," and then I said to her, "Well, sweetheart, what if something happens to me? My wife's very attractive. She could, if something were to happen to me, my wife could very easily get remarried. And so I said, honey, if you were to get remarried, how much a year would you like your next husband to make?" "Well, it was about 3 to 4 times what I make." And I said, "Honey, there's not that many men out there for these women. And then many of them are married already, and many of them are divorced. Some of them have children, and there's an apocalypse coming. And there are going to be, and this is exactly what my friend said to me 3 years ago, there are going to be a lot of women in mid to late middle age who are angry. And they're angry because they're frustrated. Because, well, here's the thing about a healthy culture. A healthy culture affords wisdom to people who have not had time in their biological lifetime to accumulate it. That's what a healthy culture does. It helps put the youth on a track where they will flourish long term. And what's happening now is a crisis because, well, let's look at these high status men. These high status men, when they finally decide that they've done the non-monogamy enough and are ready to settle down, you know, they're good looking. They're exactly what watching any of the television shows says, this is the kind of man you want. This is the kind of man you deserve. And let's say these men are successful in their careers. They're really alpha. And they're, you know, how much younger are the women going to be that they finally decide to settle down with? Mid to late 20s. You know, there's a great video out there by OKCupid that I think it was in The Atlantic that put it out. And, you know, sort of the title of it is Everyone's a Little Racist. But they also went to said, well, women are usually attracted to men that are about their age. What age of women are men attracted to? Early 20s. So these high status men are going to do what? And women who have waited, the longer they wait, the tougher it's going to be. Well, what they're going to have to do is in some ways settle. But there's a lot of interesting research about marriages where the women make more than the men. Now, there was a couple that used to be at this church. They're still friends of mine. They're wonderful people. She got a law degree. She was a legal shark. I remember playing board games with her, and she was a lawyer by birth. And she married a man who was an artist. And he was many of the things that she wasn't. And they eventually had a child, and he was the stay-at-home dad. And the marriages worked well. And so I'm not saying it can't happen, but that's sort of the point of statistics. Everybody wants to be an outlier, but being an outlier is an achievement in many ways because there are real social factors that create the kinds of things that we see. And so what are we going to do as a society?
And I think this delay thing where you wait until you're 30, 32 to get married, and then you're 35, 36, 38, 40 when you have a baby, that was kind of the sweet spot where you got to do everything. You know, you got to graduate, you got to go to grad school, you got to have the career, you got to save up and kind of have your fun and your own identity and get really stable and comfortable. And both parties could bring a lot to the marriage. And then you combine households and you have a ton of money to start off with. And
some people are, they're working that, they're making it work. But there's also this sort of selection bias that we always do. And I illustrate this by when I bought a Subaru Outback, and it was a blue Subaru Outback in 2013. And after I bought the car, I never knew there were so many Subarus out on the road. I had no idea there were so many blue Subaru 2012, 2013s out on the road. And why didn't I see it before? Well, it's because I just bought one. And, you know, recently I bought a Mazda. And now I look around and there's just Mazdas all over the place. Well, did the actual number of cars on the road change? No. I paid attention. My filters were changed by my buying decision and what I was buying. And I mean, human beings are funny this way. But, you know, I know people in their 30s that women that have decided to do in vitro and be a single mother. They Murphy Browned it. Not easy. I see women who are divorced with children in their mid-30s. Now, did see there, you practice the other one. How did that turn out, huh? Yeah, they're struggling. This is complicated. And again, part of the difficulty, for as much as we look back and say, oh, look at that. That's horrible. What we got on the plate right now, well, maybe for the people who are able to really play this game well, it will work out well. And again, part of what I see is, so I look at the different schools that are here and around, and so I have a chance to be in schools in poorer neighborhoods that are mostly filled with immigrants, and, you know, their children don't have many allergies, and, you know, the families are struggling and so on and so forth. But And then I go into the schools of choice, where, you know, these are sort of specialty schools in the district that people want to get their children into. And those schools are getting whiter and whiter. And the parents of the children get older and older, and they have better and better homes because they were able to, quote unquote, do it right, to have all that experimentation in their 20s and to get the right, to get into the right college, to get the right degree, to get the right job, to put money in the bank, to get the house in a desirable neighborhood, to get their child in a nice school, and they will only have one or two or maybe three children. But what you don't see are all those who kind of fumbled the ball at some point or another. And you do see some of them because, well, you need to have both of the parents in for separate parent-teacher meetings because the parents don't get along. It's challenging.
Only kind of loose end that you had to nail down, or save up and kind of have your fun and your own identity and get really stable and comfortable. And both parties could bring a lot to the marriage. And then you combine households and you have a ton of money to start off with. And the only kind of loose end that you had to nail down very quickly was fertility, you know, sort of the declining female fertility. This introduces a whole nother hitch into that life plan, which is now you're dealing with, well, getting a male in there who is actually college educated and has a bunch of net worth and so forth to bring to the table is going to get increasingly difficult. And so there's this rush issue, why there's going to be a kind of time crunch, which makes it more difficult to nail down your graduate studies and get your stuff together and do the things that you want to do, like travel and date and really figure out what you want in life before you get married, have all the net worth, have the baby, etc. So I think there's a huge amount of anxiety for young women who are educated and who want to lay out their lives neatly.
The difficulty with anxiety is maybe you're right to be anxious, and then some of you will do it and some of you will fail. And so anxiety will become resignation or anger
in this way. And I think they're well aware of the challenges ahead of them. And, you know, having someone be like, just marry someone that you really like when you're really young and then, you know, kind of figure it out together as a unit is just really obnoxious. It just feels really obnoxious. My parents.
It feels obnoxious, and it's hard because, again, and my wife and I talk about the fact that when we were married in the 80s, in the late 80s, we were both deeply embedded in a culture where, you know, premarital sex was not something that was blessed. In some ways, you marry for getting your free sex license. I was 25. My wife was just about ready to turn 22, you know, and hey, my wife and I, there are many years when I didn't think my marriage would hold, and that's a reality. But we both were raised and formed in cultures that said, you really work at this, you stick to it, and you don't leave. And, you know, now at this point, I'm very glad that, you know, there were a number of patches in the marriage that were really tough, but we stuck at it and we worked at it and you can make it. And again, I'm not, there are marriages that should end. I'm not one to say I'm not one to say that divorce isn't sometimes a better option. My take is that if that is the case, you'd better be very hesitant about remarriage. But I've known some people who've had wonderful second marriages, et cetera, et cetera. That's not what this is about. This is about the fact that we have, in some ways, as a culture, backed ourselves into a corner that people are going to suffer from. And if I listen to my friend, I don't know that we have any idea what the consequences of when that elite and managerial class are angry and frustrated because they have been formed by a culture that told them their career would be more meaningful than developing a satisfying family. I don't know what that looks like.
Got married, and neither of them had gone to college, that you really like when you're really young, and then, you know, kind of figure it out together as a unit, is just really obnoxious. It just feels really obnoxious. My parents got married.
The culture doesn't want to hear it. Okay.
And neither of them had gone to college. They hadn't even thought about it. My mom was working as like a bank teller. My dad was painting dorms. And they went to college while they were married. My dad graduated college the year I was born. You know, and that was how they made it work. And they did well for themselves later in life. But it was something that they did together. And so, again, to my husband and I, that was not an unusual life pattern, that you support each other through these hurdles as opposed to having everything to bring to the table, kind of like nobility when you get married. Like, I have this enormous dowry. And it's like, no, you kind of get married without a pot to piss in, and then you build it all. But I think, you know, the fact that there's all this anxiety around what kind of life plan is going to be available causes this to be a very, very, very tense area for especially women. And so I think that understandably there's a lot of stress in the public discourse about it.
And again, there's just certain things that are not fair. And it is, you know, there's aspects of this that are really hard for men, and there are aspects of this that are really hard for women. And I would imagine the women get the short end of the stick in this, which becomes tremendously ironic from a generation and a strategy that has been about female empowerment and liberation. Now, this is the kind of stuff Mary Cohen can really speak with passion and authority about from the other side of the Roman Catholic Church. And at the same time, it's very difficult because if you are also from a culture that hasn't... So Peugeot and Roland talked about the saints holding up the world. And then Roland said, literally. Don't say that word right then. That doesn't make any sense. But people will very quickly jump in the fact that the baby boomers introduced divorce into the culture at a larger rate. And now many of the people that I've spoken with, my conversations over the years, you know, the divorce of their parents drove an emotional truck through their world as a child. Andrew Root, who I had talking a while ago, wrote a really powerful Christian book on the legacy of divorce. So marrying young, I mean, marry young, there's risks. Wait, there's risks. There's challenges on both sides. There's no safe paths. It's all difficult. But I really wonder what society will look like when this managerial class of high status, high earning women have, there's sort of the pig and the python in the generational conversation. What that's going to look like? How angry will they be? If I believe my friend, you can't say when mama's not happy, nobody's happy, because they're not a mama. So I just thought that this first part, let's see, is she done there? Are they going to talk about wokeness next? That's, wokeness isn't about that. This is going to be a short video.
That's very interesting. And yeah, I think that there's a lot of interesting things in these findings that actually women are outcompeting men in high schools and therefore getting degrees at a higher rate. That both goes against sort of the general narrative about what's happening in our society at the moment, but also helps to explain some of those gender dynamics and even some of the sort of reaction you might get on Twitter or something like that. I think that's right. We had a little bit of a chat before the interview, and you said it really annoys you when people liken wokeness to a religion. And
all right, that's what, hopefully, if I follow up with the next video, that'll be that part of the conversation. So I'll leave the link below and the link to Chris's video. And, you know, I haven't finished listening to this video either. I'm now, you know, just listening. Of course, the algorithm queued this one up because, you know, I've done some commentary on some of Chris's work again lately and queued this one up, and the title grabbed me, and I thought, I don't know. Maybe I'm just getting old, and maybe I'm just old-fashioned. But when I listen to my friend, I wonder. Anyway, I think comments will be left on this video. That won't surprise me at all. I look forward to reading them.